I'm Marty, and I'm a grateful follower of Jesus Christ. I struggle with anger and shame. It's definitely a privilege for me, sincerely, to be with you tonight. It's a privilege. But I want to share my story, and a good way to start it is growing up in Sacramento, the family across the street would look at our family and have no idea. From across the street, we would look like the average, typical American family. But they would have no idea how off they were. In seventh grade, my identity was built around sports and school, both those things. And this little story will give you an insight to what I was like when I was young. Seventh grade, I loved basketball. We didn't have a seventh grade team, so I went out for the ninth grade team. And they were going to only keep 10 players. And so the guys were down to 11 guys. So there's one more to be cut. And I felt like I had a chance to make the team, probably not to start because they're mostly ninth graders. But the final cut would be on Friday. So my life was just focused on that. On Wednesday, the basketball coach was also my science teacher. And that was another part of my identity, was doing well in school. And so we're taking a test on Wednesday. The kid in front of me, Mike Yoakum, turns around. He says, "What'd you get for number 6? I said, "Shut up, turn around." And so he does, and we finished the test, and we exchanged tests with each other, and we graded each other's tests. Then the teacher would call everyone's name, and he skipped over my name. And he called, Brown, and whoever graded mine would tell him the score, but he didn't call my name. So after he did all that, I said, "Mr. Kirby, you didn't call my name." He goes, "Well, I didn't have to. I know what you got." I said, "Oh, well, what did I get?" And he said, "You get an F because you cheated." I said, "I didn't cheat." And he said, "I saw you. You cheated. You got an F." So that was a blow to me. But it got bigger when I went to practice that day. I dressed down, I'm out on the court, and the coach said, "Didn't you see the roster on my window?" And so I thought the cut was Friday. He said, "No, the cut was today. You need to go check it out." Well, I went in there and I was cut. And so I asked him, I went out and I said, "Why did I get cut today?" And he said, "I don't let cheaters on my team." So I was... That was my world in one day. It took two big blows. So that night I was in my bedroom and I was crying. And it was just a devastating day for me. And my mom comes in and she said, "What's wrong?" So I told her. And she said, "Well, don't worry about it. It's going to be okay." Well, what this story kind of gives some insight to is, one is my dad was very unconnected to us as kids. I was the oldest of four kids, and we were just on our own. And as far as I know to this day, he didn't know what happened that day. He had no idea that my world caved in on me that day. And that was a picture of my relationship. My dad was also a very hostile, angry person, angry to the point of scary. And so I did everything I could to stay out of harm's way and just be vigilant and see when the storms were coming and just try and keep my head down. Well, I kind of also illustrated my mom a little bit. She was the peacekeeper. Her job was to keep everything buffered away from my dad and not let him get upset. Her other job was, I would say she was my denial mentor. It's okay, it'll be okay, and just deny what just happened. And I was a very good pupil at that. I became good at denial. And I experienced a lot of pain as a kid. And I think some of it was very real. Some of it was probably perceived, just the way I viewed things. But I experienced a lot of pain, and one of the ways I managed pain was to ignore it, to try not to feel it. I'd try and cut the highs and lows off of my emotions. I'd try not to get too high because that was just setting me up for a fall. and I'd try to ignore the lows so that I didn't have to feel that pain. And so my mom mentored me in being a denial expert. As a result, I was very alone. I have very few memories as a kid. And there just were no family memories, really. And I kind of, like from 5 years previous, I have two memories. And one's being the milk monitor at kindergarten. That's the only two memories, and another one. Then from 5 to 8, I had some memories. But then something in our house changed at 8. And from then on, I didn't do anything. My dad disappeared. He became a workaholic, an alcoholic. He just was out of the picture, if not physically, emotionally. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I learned what changed was that he had sexually abused my sisters. And I didn't know that for decades. But I knew something changed. I knew something was different. And so I was very on my own, experienced a lot of loneliness. By 15, I was providing for myself. I moved out when I was 15, and I still went to high school, but I worked like from 4 a.m. till 7 a.m. Then I'd go to school, then I'd do sports till about 8 at night, then I'd do homework till midnight and only get 4 hours sleep a night. Excuse me. As an old person now, I can't even fathom how that happened. But I think looking back, I just learned to live on adrenaline. I just lived on adrenaline. To some people, that might look really cool, like, oh, he's so industrious, so hardworking. But I'm telling you, I lived so unhealthy. In college, it got worse. I worked from midnight till 6:30 every morning, drove to school, would take a class, take about a 20-minute nap, take other classes, another nap, would have a job in the afternoon. I was involved in things in the evening, and maybe get 2 or 3 hours sleep a night. And then on Sundays, I'd sleep like all day, which fit me because I had no religious, spiritual background. Our family had zero. I had zero. When I was in middle school, I asked my mom, what's Easter? In those days, you had Easter vacation instead of spring break. She said, I don't know. None of us had any idea what Easter is. I just had no spiritual thoughts at all. And I'd just sleep all day Sunday. So I was very alone. I was driven. I'd manage my expectations. My goal would just be to become invisible so that I would not be a target for hurt. And I could disappear in a crowd. I'd be the guy that they took the picture and didn't realize I wasn't there. You know, I just kind of lived a very quiet, invisible life as a kid. I had anger. My dad had huge anger, and I wasn't allowed to express my emotion at home because he would just fire out on me. So when I had anger, it just became very repressed and just built and built and built until I got out from under him, and then it's like there's no restraint, and boom. So like in basketball, twice I hit referees. And not a technical, but hit them in a game. Got kicked out, needless to say. So I had a lot of anger going. So then the slats started kind of getting knocked out from under me that my identity was built on. Just like in seventh grade is devastating. Again, my senior year in high school is devastating. I had the fifth highest SAT score in our high school, and I got rejected by the three top colleges that I applied to. And it wasn't Harvard, Yale, and Columbia. It was Oregon State, Humboldt State, and Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo. And I got rejected. So I ended up at the prestigious Sacramento State, right there in the hometown. And so that got knocked, that was very humbling and painful to have that knocked out from under me. My freshman year in college, I was on the basketball team and the golf team in college, and both seasons ended mid-season because I had to have a tumor removed from my spine. So both my sports that I loved caved in. I didn't get to finish those. So the slats were starting to get knocked out from under me that I was building my structure on. Then my freshman year in college, about 12 different people shared with me how I could know God personally. Oh, I've got a tickle, I'm sorry. And people I knew, people I didn't know, classmates, lab mates, teammates, and they'd say, hey, can I talk to you about how you can know God personally? Thanks, bud. I don't know what's going on. And I listened to some, but I really just blew them all off, even though I listened to them. That's not me. And the way I was taking it is, you're saying I'm sinful, I'm bad, I should be guilty. I don't feel that way. I feel like I live a fairly decent moral life, and I'm good to others and so forth. And so I just stiff-armed them all through my freshman year. And then another slap that got knocked out from under me was that summer, my job, I was delivering things, and I pulled out at 2 a.m., pulled out onto a main artery, and I didn't see him, but out of nowhere, this motorcycle came flying over the hill and hit the front of my truck. And the driver of the motorcycle flew over the hood and skipped down the road at least 2 to maybe 3 times the distance from here to that door. And my heart just froze. I jump out thinking, I just killed this guy. And I ran down there. Now, this is Sacramento. It's August. It's 102 degrees at about 2 in the morning. It's really hot. I get down there. He's got a ski cap on. And he's rolling around semi-conscious, swearing. And on the concrete is a handgun. And then my heart froze again. And so I kick it away. And I ran to the nearest house. So I know he's alive, but he's not doing real good. And that's pre-911, you young people. 911 didn't always exist. So I wake someone up, and cell phones didn't exist, and all kinds of stuff didn't exist. So I called the ambulance, I called the police, I called my boss, I called everything I could think of, and waited away. Well, it turns out this guy had just robbed a 7-Eleven, and they estimate he's going 100 miles an hour when he hit my truck. So it shook me. And my boss said, Marty, take a week off and just gather yourself. I'll cover for you. I'll take your route. So for me, my sanctuary in those days, being a person that is alone, was the mountains. I loved the outdoors. I loved the mountains. So I called my buddy, Jerry, let's go camping. When? Right now. Let's go. I need to get out of here. So the two of us go up for a week to camp up in the Sierras. And that night, we had dinner, and I love seeing the stars where there's no light and just how majestic it is. And we walked about 20 minutes down the hill from where we're camping and just enjoyed that. And we walked back up and got into the tent, and apparently what happened is a bear followed us back up the trail. So we're in the tent, and this bear is sniffing around, rooting around. I had a Coleman ice chest like this. He would pick it up and popped it open on a rock and ate a week's worth of all of our meat and food. And then my friend had his sister's Hope chest that he didn't ask, this metal chest lined with cedar. He didn't ask to borrow it, but we had our bread and our chips and stuff that chipmunks would get in. And he put a gash. He couldn't get it open, but there's this claw mark gash into this metal thing. Totally made her mad. And we're like, we don't get this. Who has a Hope chest with a bear claw? You know, but she didn't see our way of thinking. So we're in the tent. We're trying to think, Should we make noise and scare him, or will that cause him to come in? And we don't know. And we're trying to figure it out. And I'm just trying to be brave. And I said, Jerry, it just wants to come in. It only would come in if there's food. He just wants food. We're going to be okay. And my friend said, oh, Marty, all my cookies and sweets are in the tent. And so I just lost it. I said, oh, my God, he's coming in. And if I was a basketball and someone, it looked like someone is dribbling me. I was shaking so hard. And this is what he said. He said, you know, I just learned in church that you shouldn't use the Lord's name in vain like that. What the heck are you talking about? Using the Lord's name in vain? There's a bear growling this much canvas away from us, you know? And so anyway, we made noise, the bear laughed, and truth be told, knowing what I know now, it's probably a black bear, and it probably wasn't the threat that I thought it was at the time, but it was a real threat in my mind at the time. And I didn't sleep all night. But all night I'm just thinking, what if I would have died right here? What if I would have been shot by that robber? What if that bear would have eaten me? Who would even know? Maybe my mom. I'm not even sure my dad would know, honestly. And I thought, there's got to be more to life than just living for a while to die. There's got to be some meaning. So anyway, the next morning, my buddy's sitting at the picnic table, and I come out, and I said, hey, let's go swimming. And he goes, no, let's do that later. I said, well, let's go fishing then. He goes, no, not just yet. And I said, well, let's go for a hike. And he goes, I don't want to do that right now. And I started getting mad. I said, Jerry, I didn't come up here to sit around all week. And he said, well, I just like to read my Bible for a half hour to start every day. So I want to do that before we do anything. And I go, okay, well, let's do that. Well, I'd never, ever, ever seen the inside of a Bible. And so this is my first time. And every morning for that week, we read through the Gospels about Jesus' life. And Jesus just started to pull me in. I just thought, man, if this is God, and this is a picture of love, and he speaks with authority, I'm interested. And I started connecting to those 12 conversations I'd had the last year. And kind of a longer story short, I started reading the Bible that one of those 12 had given me that I'm surprised I didn't throw away, but I just threw in my closet. I start reading this Bible every day for about 3 months. In October, about midnight in my grandma's house, I asked Christ to come into my life and to forgive my sin. And so right away I saw some changes. I started becoming more people-oriented than I was. I'm almost positive there's not a person in here that is more shy than I was in high school and college. I was so introverted, I probably was not only painful for me, but for others to be around me. And I just started being more people-oriented. And my major was forestry, and I was going to work in a fire tower somewhere, have a dog, and live by myself in the mountains. That was my dream, but God started changing that and started connecting me to people. And I just started growing socially. A guy took me under his wing, started to disciple me. And I learned just things about God, but I learned things about his family. He just pulled me into his family, and I saw how a real family is supposed to act. And started to get a better picture of what a family was. And that started to change in me. You know, I no longer hit referees, but I still got technicals. And if I was in shape to play ball, that would still be a very real possibility. But I just became less alone and more connected to people. And that was a huge change. You know, I learned to allow people to speak into my life. And I didn't have the fear that they're out after to harm me. You know, and I just didn't have that with my dad. I remember telling my dad once that something that happened at school that was kind of rough, and go get the boxing gloves. So I get the boxing gloves. He puts them on, and then he just beats me to a pulp. And I'm just getting beat, and I'm thinking, what am I learning here? He's not instructing me how to protect myself or anything. He's just mad that I had an issue, and he just took his anger out on me. And so I was very slow to let people speak into me, but as I came to Christ, I started to allow that. And one very cool time, you know, I'd actually been a Christian for a little while. My daughter's away at Arizona State for College, and her car was totaled, and we had to get her a new car, and we found this great $2,000 deal. So I tell my buddy, hey, I'm going to drive it down and fly back, and he goes, hey, I'll come with you. Well, my daughter had all these things going on, financial problems, some emotional problems, her car, and this and that. And so I get in there, and I've got like half a day to solve it all. And so I just go, okay, well, let's get a budget. Here's how, and quit worrying about that. And let's, okay, here's this, and here, and be sure with the car you maintain it. And then she had to work for 2 hours, and then we'd get dinner with her, then we had to fly out. And so she went to work, and my buddy said, well, how do you think that went? And I said, well, I think it went pretty good. We covered a lot of ground, and if she follows through on it, you know. And he goes, well, do you mind if I speak into my view of this? And I said, no, please. And he said, I think what she needs is a hug. She didn't need you to fix everything. She needs her dad to love her and to hug her. And that's something I never received. And that was foreign to me. But I was blessed by having the faith to let people speak honestly into my life. That's why I love this group, because that's, you guys are that way. And it is the healthy way to be. And so I have a lot of good friends that speak in. I'm going to just share a couple defining times in my growth. One was I was transferred in the ministry to Utah to be an area director over 3 states in the ministry. And so I was over my team of peers, and I was over the local Salt Lake City team. And it was April, you know, of a school year. And by April, we'd had every family, either on my team or under me, over at our house to dinner twice and some 3 times. And it just hits me one day. I'm like, no one has invited me to their house. What's up with that? And you start thinking, and that hit a very tender spot, because I've just not been pursued. I've not felt that pursuit. And you connect the dots that they haven't invited you, they haven't pursued you, therefore you must not have any value. And it gets back to the shame thing for me. And, you know, when I first heard the gospel, they were talking to me on a guilt level, which is true. You know, we're sinful. There's a price to pay. Jesus paid the price. That's true. But guilt isn't my big issue. Shame is. And more about, is there any inherent value in you that would draw someone to pursue you? So as I was dealing with this pain of reenacting my childhood, really, and like the 27 years of my marriage that my dad was alive before he passed away, he came to see us twice, 27 years. And that, I could just go on and on. That was my story of not being pursued. So this was painful. And then, you know, I'm thinking through this, and it's hurtful, and all of a sudden it floods through me. Here's my favorite verses. 1 John 4:9, not that I first loved him, but that he loved me and sent his son to be the propitiation for my sin. John 15:16, not that I chose him, but that he chose me that I might bear fruit. Romans 8, he adopted me as his son. And on, Psalms 23:6, surely goodness and mercy will follow you, which means will hunt you down all the days of your life. And then Zephaniah 3:17, it says, our God is a mighty warrior, and he delights in you. And that is mind-boggling to me. the God Almighty, the creator of the universe, delights in me. There's no place for shame. Now, I still feel it at times because I'm still trying to reprogram. But I have value. And the value is not because of what I did, not because of my grades, not because of my athleticism, which doesn't exist anymore. But it's because God put that value on me. He says, you know what? I delight in you. You have great worth. And I pursued you. I sent 12 people after you. I put you in a motorcycle accident. I brought a bear up the hill. You are so obstinate that I went to great lengths to hunt you down. And I delight in you. That was a very defining time because it hit right where I was at in my shame. Then another defining time was I had two things happen at once. Once I was fired. I never thought I'd ever be fired. I think I could prove in a court of law I shouldn't have been fired. And for sure the way they did it was just a bad, bad process. Very, very painful. And for someone that feels rejected or dismissed, it was just awful. So I went through that. And then I had physical problems. My thyroid, your thyroid should be the size of a walnut. And mine was bigger than a grapefruit. Like, it wouldn't fit in a lot of your necks. It was so big, but since I have a big neck. And that led to diabetes because my thyroid whacked out. It whacked out my insulin and diabetes. It whacked out my cholesterol, which was always fine. And I think basically what happened is decades of living on adrenaline, I just blew out my thyroid. So I had both these things hitting. I was at a really low point. And the national leaders that fired me sent me to this leadership development thing for just to honor me, I guess. Wasn't to fix what my needs were. But there's a counselor there and a seminary professor. And so the counselor and I were talking about anger. And we had some good discussions on it, and there's a lot I'd love to say about that time. But at one point I said, well, let me tell you something that happened to me in high school. How do I deal with this in with my anger? How does anger fit into this? I'm four of us are driving in a pickup, two driving, two in the back. I'm in the back of the pickup, and we're driving down the street, so I'm facing backwards. We're going this way. And over to the side, this man is beating a nine-year-old to a pulp. With a belt, probably his dad. And I don't remember a conscious thought. I had one foot up, the other foot on the side of the thing, and I went over. My friend said we were going about 35 miles an hour, which doesn't sound very fast, but don't do it. I just went rolling, and just the way it turned out, I just came up to my feet, just 4 feet from this guy, and just drilled him. And knocked him down. And I'm just shaking. I said, don't you ever do that again. And the boy's running away. So I asked this counselor, I said, how would I not be angry with that? He said, what we need to do is operate out of love, not anger. He said, Marty, one of the issues you're going to wrestle with is there's many good things you do, but it's out of anger. He said, perhaps you initiate with other people, it's out of anger, and subconsciously you're thinking, I'll be damned if that person doesn't get initiated like I didn't get initiated with. He said, do you see how that's not love, that's anger? And it made sense. I said, okay, well, how about this thing? He said, well, there's maybe 100 ways you could have done it, but here's how you know it's love and not anger. You would have loved the perpetrator. He's saying, I would love the person beating this kid to a pulp. I had three thoughts go through my mind like that. There's no way I could do that. Only Jesus could do that. Jesus is radical, and I want to be like him. And that just took a turn in my journey of, I want my life to transform. I want to be more like Jesus. And the only way I can love someone like that is by experiencing the Father's love, the Heavenly Father's love for me and His grace for me, and let Him transform my life. And I want to be more like that. Well, I'm just almost there. No. Not even close. So ongoing growth. My mom has Alzheimer's, and it pokes me all the time, because what she used to do in her healthy days, she's doing now, not because of dysfunction, but because of disease. But it provokes me, and it just pokes different wounds in me. She used to always, Marty, how old's Megan? And one day I just got mad. I said, Mom, quit asking me. Get a pencil and write this down. Grandma, you should know. And that was so painful for me that that's what my kids got from my parents. And she does the same thing now, but not because of the dysfunction, but because of Alzheimer's. She doesn't even know it's me all the time, let alone how old my kids are. But when that happens, I'm just having to learn to not let that poke me, to let God heal those things. Because as far as my mom, she's not going to change. All that can change right now is me and this right here. The other thing that I'm seeking growth on is to be more instinctual about who I am, and less like if something happens and I still feel shame. For some reason, the time it hits me the most is when I take a shower, because I replay the day yesterday. You know, I'm thinking through yesterday, and I think about something that I said wrong, or tomorrow I'll probably think about something I wasn't clear on tonight, and I'll just get this shiver and just go, oh, why did you do that? You idiot. And it's embarrassing, because my wife will hear that. She'll go, what? I was just thinking out loud, just leave me alone. But I can process through. No, God delights in you. God sent His Son for you. You are worth the Son. That is the value you have. And I can mechanically go through my identity, but I want to grow to a point where it's instinctual, that I don't have to walk through those steps. A lot of times I don't, but times I do, if that makes sense. I want it to be more instinctual, and I want it to be less knowledge and more heart, that I feel that. I feel God's love. I don't know about His love, but I feel it. I feel it. And that's where I'm in my growth right now, is those two things. Last two thoughts. I'm learning that the less I pretend, the more I can experience people's acceptance of me, the more I can experience God's acceptance of me. There's no more accepting group than this group. That's why I love this group. And the more I allow that, the more I feel accepted. Don't pretend. That takes too much effort. Just be real. And let God prove that acceptance from His point and through others to me. The last thing is, God's love and grace are infinite. And so the journey I'm on, it just makes sense that it'll be a lifetime journey of going deeper and deeper in His love and His grace. And when I'm at the end of my time, I want to be able to say, you know, I know and experience His love and grace to the level He wanted me to in my days here. That's my journey here. Thanks for letting me be a part.